Kentucky was the West. And in fact, long before it was mentioned by Greeley, go west, young men, go west, we'd already went west. We were in Kentucky, some folks was, and just was a lot going on. So get the book if you can. There's a lot of things in there. And also starting, I think, on about page number 26, I have a 10 pages here. It's a good civic lesson, especially for the kids, on First Amendment rights. Now, we're dealing a lot today with First Amendment and Second Amendment rights. And it's like the brother said this morning, I don't care who becomes president. I do care, but I think regardless, we're going to have some problems with First and Second Amendment rights through this next outfit that gets in, no matter who it is. So I want you to learn what your rights are. And you may not be able to do anything about it, but at least you'll know the truth. People don't know the truth anymore, see? We get some guy that comes on television and he says, now, the First Amendment means separation of church and state. Well, that's not true. In fact, the separation of church and state has absolutely nothing to do with First Amendment rights. And the fact of the matter is, it doesn't have really anything to do with the Constitution of the United States. We make it do that, but it doesn't. So you need to get this. Here's what I want you to understand. Anytime we pass a law in this state or in the United States, here's what happens. Though you just don't get up there and somebody reads a law and you vote on it. A lot of times those laws, most times those laws, you have different amendments to those laws. And I have in this book the fact that there were 10 amendments to or 10 drafts to the First Amendment, you know, and they chose the final one, of course, Congress shall make no law, so on and so forth, and concerning, you know, about your religious rights. And I have that all in there. I'm at an age I can't remember anything anymore, but here's what the one I wish they would have left alone. And on number 5, on September 3rd, 1789, this draft was given, and it says this: the Senate met and considered several versions of the amendment. This was the one that was offered and rejected. Congress shall make no law establishing one religious sect or society in preference to others. See, that's what the First Amendment is about. It has nothing to do with separation of church and state, but it has everything to do with that the government should not be allowed to tell you where to go to church, when to go to church, how to go to church, and what church you got to financially support. That's what it's about. In 1801, the Danbury Baptist Connecticut Association wrote a letter to Thomas Jefferson concerned about what was going on in Connecticut about their religious freedom. He answered them in a letter, and by the way, that letter's in here. He answered them in a letter that's also in here, and where he says, there is a separation of church and state. Now, this occurred 13 years after the First Amendment was written. So when somebody tells you the First Amendment has to do with separation of church and state, they're either ignorant or they're lying. And I highly suspect most of the time they want you to be ignorant, and they're going to lie to you because there's an agenda that they're trying to shove down your throat. So don't swallow it. Well, I'm going to take a few minutes, and I promise you we will be out of here by 12 o'clock. History is a lot sometimes like math. It can be boring. I know I've spent years studying it, and I'm not going to give you the boring parts today, okay? I'm going to give you a quick surmise of American history and Kentucky Baptist history. And for text, I've got to use Matthew chapter 16. You don't have to, if you want to turn there, you're fine, you can. But it talks about the fact in Matthew chapter 16 and that Jesus said that he would start a church and the gates of hell would not prevail against it. Now we know that in verse 17, verse 18 of chapter number 16 of Matthew. Now here's the thing. Did he start a church or not? And the answer is yes, he did. Whose church is it? Is it your church? No. Is it the Baptist church? We're not discussing that. It's his church. It's His church, and so it must be run accordingly as He wanted to be run. And we can find all those distinctives, especially in Paul's writings about the church. Now, here's the thing I want to get across to you. Did he start a church? Yes. What else did he say about the church? He said the gates of hell should not prevail against it. What does that mean? That means that from his time that he walked on his earth, on this earth until right now, there has been somewhere in this country or in this world, somewhere, a church that has been preaching the truth. Now you say, well, we've made it, well, it don't agree with us. Well, friend, let me tell you something. If this town's like every other town, you've got this independent Baptist church here, you've got one downtown, you may have a few others around, but you can drive 20 miles in any direction and find a Baptist church, and I guarantee you they will not agree with you 100% on anything. But those distinctives are there, and that's what we're talking about. We also know from studying the Scripture early on that the church got under persecution, and in the book of Acts, we see it fleeing. And from history, we understood that the church was persecuted, and those people would flee to the mountains of Europe and Asia and all over that part of the world. But they still maintain these doctrinal truths. Now, down through those 1500, 1600, 1700 years, we know there's a church somewhere on the face of earth teaching the truth. We do finally realize that in the 1500s, that group is going to be in England. We know that. We know in early 1600, that group has decided that they're under such persecution that they need to leave and come to what we call America. And so they boarded a ship. In fact, there were two ships. There was the Mayflower and the Speedwell. You don't hear much about the Speedwell because it developed a leak. And after two or three tries of getting it to go and getting behind in a couple of months, they finally left it, and everybody got on the Mayflower, and they came to America. But they got a late start, and they didn't get to America, and they didn't get exactly where they wanted to be. And they got here in late November of 1620. You know what happens when you're landing in Massachusetts in 1620? You're going to get cold. Snow knee-deep. Water's icy cold. 102 people who came over and 30 crewmen who came over on that little boat that wasn't but about 95 foot long and 25 foot wide and had four levels to it. And they had to stay in the one section that was less than 1,000 square foot. Can you imagine? Now, me and my wife, we're long, just her and I now. The kids are all grown, and the grandkids, the great-grandkids, they come see us occasionally. But we've got a little small three-bedroom house that's 1,300 square foot. I can't imagine 1,000 people living in 1,300 square foot with me for 2 months. But that's what happened on the Mayflower. In fact, sometimes when the grandkids come to visit, it's hard for me to imagine that they're going to be here for 4 or 5 days. Listen, grandparents, you love headlights, but don't tail lights look sometimes as good as headlights when they're leaving? Amen. I know exactly that feeling. So I just can't imagine being on a boat with 102 people for 2 months in a little cramped up section, but they made it and they got here. Got here at a bad time. Came off board and came to land. Many of them did, waited because they had no other way to get to land. And what happens in late November? Man, you're going to catch pneumonia. Many of them did. Many of them died from other things. So when spring gets here, of that 102 people, you've only got 50-some left. Why did they do that? I'll tell you why they did it. They did it for religious freedom. The reason you and I are sitting here today in this beautiful building with these great pews, air-conditioned, praise the Lord for that, and these padded pews, is because there was somebody who came before us who was willing to pay a price that we may have these comforts that we have today. Don't you ever forget that. I've always said there's two people or two classes of people that we've totally ignored. We've ignored our veterans, and shame on us for doing that. And we have ignored our forefathers. We forgot about them. We forgot about the prices they paid. We forgot about the children that they buried. We forgot about the spouses that they buried. We forgot about the lands they left behind to come here and start over for religious freedom. We forgot all about that because we've gotten too comfortable in our surroundings. So they come to America on the Mayflower. Well, those are what we call the pilgrims. They didn't refer to themselves as pilgrims. They referred to themselves as separatists. Why separatists? I'll tell you why separatists. Because the Church of England was the ruling class in England. And it was they were in conflict with one another spiritually. And they wanted to separate themselves from the Church of England. So they came to America. Now, you've seen the picture, haven't you? Of the pilgrims, they tried to get you to believe it's the pilgrims, of the guys all dressed in black and white, and the big black hats. Well, those really are not pilgrims. That pilgrims dressed in everyday dress. Those folks there are folks that are called Puritans. They're called Puritans because they wanted to stay in the Church of England, and they wanted to try and straighten it up. The problem is that we've seen over the years, especially in religious ranks, that does not hardly ever work. Hardly ever will that work. And so you got the pilgrims coming, the pilgrims separatists. They said, we don't want to be a part of that anymore. Later on, 1628, you got the Puritans start coming here. And they start coming in droves. And man, by 1643, you got thousands of people in the colonies, but the majority of them are Puritans. They had not left the Church of England. And having not left the Church of England, they wanted to force on these pilgrims, as we call them, these separatists, they wanted to force their beliefs on them. That's the same thing, the problem they had when they were in England. And so the problem starts. Now, by 1700, you got 300,000 people in these colonies of ours. And of those 300,000, the Puritans, the bad guys, we'll call them, outnumbered the separatists, the good guys, somewhere like 20 to 1. Now, how are you going to get anything done when it's 20 to 1? I mean, you just can't do it. These folks wanted to serve God their way. These folks over here who outnumbered them 20 to 1 said, no, you're not going to do that. And so problem starts. Well, by 1750, you've got 2.5 million people in this country. But by then, the Puritans only outnumber the good guys 3 to 1. Now, when the number is 3 to 1, maybe you've got a chance to get something done. You men who, I grew up in the streets, but you men who've been in encounters a time or two in your life, when the number is 20 to 1, I suggest you run. When the number is 3 to 1, maybe you can pick up a stick and be all right for a while, but maybe you can get something accomplished. So when the number is 3 to 1, they start pushing for their religious right. These pilgrims do, these folks, these separatists do. They want to be able to serve God the way they want to serve God. Now, you had, at that time, 13 colonies in this state, in this country. 9 of those colonies had what I call church-ran organizations. You had to go to their church. In the north, it was the congregational bunch. You had to go to the congregational church, or there's going to be problems. You had to take your children to the congregational church, or there's going to be problems. In the south, the Anglicans ran it, the Church of England group, they ran it. And in the south, you had to go to their church or there's going to be problems. You had to take your children in to be baptized by them or there's going to be problems. And they started coming up with all these different laws. We don't have time to go into any of that. But you had to be a part of their group. And if you didn't want to be a part of their group, you was going to be fined. You're going to be punished. And one of the ways they would find you is that you were taxed to support their churches. Now, can you imagine that? In this state of Kentucky, our governor, Governor Bevin, puts out a declaration that says, from now on, you folks down there in Madisonville, Grace Baptist Church, you're going to have to start supporting the Catholic Church. We're going to make that the state church now. You're going to start supporting. You say, well, we don't want to be no part of that. Well, then you understand how these folks failed. They didn't want that either. Man, Virginia, who, and I really like Virginia because we at one time were Virginia, they passed some ridiculous laws, and because of that, people suffered tremendously. At one time in 1643, they passed a law that said this, that it would cost you, you would pay a price if you taught publicly about anything concerning Baptists or anything that opposed the Church of England. And later on, in 1655, they were forced to pay £15 from every head of household in order to support the Anglican Church of England. Later on, 1661, they upped that to £50. Later on, 1662, it would cost you £2,000 of tobacco if you refused to have your children baptized in a Church of England church. You see the problems they faced? I mean, and not only were we facing problems spiritually, we were facing problems politically. War's about to break out. You know that. 1775, war's about to break out. We got ourselves in a problem with England, and we got into a war, a revolutionary war that's going to cost us $150 million, of which we didn't have. So how are you going to pay soldiers? I'll show you in a minute. 1776, we have the Declaration of Independence. In 1787, we got the Constitution. 1789, we had the Bill of Rights, which came about as a meeting between John Leland and James Madison, you know, and they decided, Leland said, I'll step down if you give us these 10 Bill of Rights, which now there are 27, by the way. And so the war was fought, and we won the war, you know that. But then time comes to start paying the soldiers. How do you pay when you owe $150 million, you don't have, how do you pay soldiers? Well, Virginia was Kentucky was a part of Virginia, and it's pretty well unsettled. And so they got this bright idea that what we'll do is we'll give this land to our soldiers, and they can go over there. And so if you were a soldier, you were given X amount of acres of land, and if you were, it may be as much as 1,000 acres, and you could go down, you could go to move to Kentucky with your family, and you could build your house there, and you could put out a crop there, and if it was successful, the next year you could buy another 1,000 acres or so for $8 or $9. Boy, those days are gone. But that's what they did. And a lot of the folks said, hey, that's a good idea, and so they started coming into Kentucky. Some of them didn't want to come in because mom and daddy had a farm. They lived on the farm. They inherited the farm. And so they didn't want to leave Virginia. So they sold their little treasury grants to other people. That's how you had a man. That's how you had men. And especially a former president of the United States that ended up with 90-some thousand acres because he bought. He was a speculator. They would buy that land off men who didn't want to come here. Then in 1775, you got a fellow by the name of Richard Henderson, a judge from North Carolina, who meets with Daniel Boone and the Cherokee Indians down at what's today is Elizabethton, Tennessee, Sycamore Shoals, and they buy 20 million acres of land off the Cherokee for $50,000 in bartered good. And that land that they bought basically was Kentucky. Well, that sounds like a good deal, and it is. The problem was twofold problem. Number one, they didn't even own it. The Cherokees never owned the land any more than any of the other Indians owned the land. This was just big prime hunting ground. But they saw an opportunity to sell it to the white man for $50,000 in bartered goods, and so they sold it to Henderson. The other problem with it, in 1763, British, and we were still under British rule in 75, the British had passed a law that said no individual could buy or have dealings like this with the Indians. And so Henderson broke both of those. How he thought to get away with it, I don't know. I've researched him, and to this day I have no idea why he thought he could get away with that. But he did. He thought he could. Well, so Boone comes in, and Boone cuts that trail through across the Cumberland Gap, all the way up to Boonesboro, where Boonesboro is today. It was a good idea Henderson had. He was going to start another colony. He was going to start the 14th colony. He was going to call it Transylvania, and the headquarters would be there at Boonesboro. Good idea, and he would sell the land off to these settlers that would come in, and they could buy it cheap, because he'd certainly bought it cheap, and that way they could populate Kentucky, and he would make tons and tons of money, and the folks that backed him up would make tons of money. But after a couple of years, Virginia said, no, that's not how it's going to happen. And so Mr. Henderson lost everything except for, in fact, not too far from here. He got 12 square miles out of the deal over here at Henderson, Kentucky. That's all he got out of it. But there's a lot of problems involved in that. Of course, we don't have time to go on all that. But Boone cut the trail through, and folks started coming in. Now, you've got problems here in Kentucky because, as Filson said, John Filson, if you ever heard the John Filson Society, Filson is the fellow that made Daniel Boone a household word, by the way. Filson was the fellow that wrote about Daniel Boone. Daniel Boone was probably not near as big a hero as Fess Parker made him out to be, but nevertheless, John Filson made him a household word. Filson himself was an educator, a writer. He was a surveyor. He's one of the fellows that founded Cincinnati, Ohio. In fact, when he was out on a surveying trip, when he was just really probably in his early 40s, he ended up disappearing. Of course, we all know what happened to him. The Indians got him. Filson called Kentucky a dark and bloody ground. Why? Well, man, there were savages here, and there was constant battles going on between the Indians and the white people. And you got to understand, I'm not going to take sides on that. You got to understand some of that. But it was a dark and bloody ground. By the year 1800, there was over 1,500 settlers that had lost their life. I'm talking about mamas who saw their babies picked up by the legs and slammed their heads against a tree. I'm talking about mamas who saw their children kidnapped and taken off, and some of them ended up in Canada and never came home again. John Tanner's son, old preacher John Tanner, his son was that way. You saw, mama saw their children, babies, and daughters, and children, or sons, scalped right in front of the very eye. Saw their husband killed. Many of the women were killed. It was a dark and bloody ground. Why would anybody want to come here? But they came here because it was a land of opportunity. It was a land where you had an opportunity once again to serve God the way you wanted to serve Him. Not only was it a land of serving God, it was a land naturally of speculation. You could come here as a land speculator. You could get some land. You could start a garden. You could start a farm. And with what the government give you, you'd be all right. Why did they do that? Why was it that men who had spent literally months in prison in Virginia and other parts of the colonies decided one day, we've had enough, we're getting out of here? That's why you got men like Lewis Craig. One Sunday afternoon, September 1781, there him and his whole church, or probably most of his church, decided we're going to Kentucky. And they took off walking to Kentucky in 1781. They walked through the Cumberland Gap, spent a while over at what is now Abington, Virginia, there at Black's Fort, and came through the Gap and came up the Rock Castle there, river, and came through my area there up to Lincoln County, and ended up over there close to, not too far from where I live at, in Lincoln County. What's Lincoln? It's Lincoln County. It's Garrett County, in that, right there on that line there, and started Gilbert's Creek Regular Baptist Church. Been about a year and a half there, and he'll move farther north. He'll start a number of churches as he moves farther north. Finally ends up in Mason County. He's buried up there in somebody's front yard in Mason County. Later on, right after him, you'll have another fellow come in from that same area and start a church that's down creek from Craig. He'll start, this is where a lot of confusion, he'll start Gilbert's Creek Separate Baptist. You got a regular Baptist up this creek, and you got Separate Baptist just a half a mile away. Both got the same name, Gilbert's Creek. What's the difference between Separate Baptist and regular Baptist? Not that much. That's about it. The one of them said we adhere to no, Separate Baptist said we don't have any creed except the Bible, and the regular Baptist said, we adhere to the Philadelphia Confession of Faith. But as far as practical doctrine, about that much difference. That first church went out of existence in just a few years. It never had a building there or nothing. Later on up on the hill, that separate Baptist church, they built a building, but they went out of existence right after the Civil War. The man there, Bledsoe, he was a great man of God. He started Crab Orchard Baptist Church. I'll get to that in a minute. But his grandson grew up there. His name is R.E.B. Baylor. Became a very, very prominent lawyer in Kentucky, Alabama, and finally in Texas. And he's the fellow that started Baylor University. A lot of history in Kentucky, folks. A lot of history in Kentucky. Out of that same group came a fellow by the name of Jeremiah Vardaman. Vardaman, I like him because even though he's Baptist, he's going to baptize a lot of people. He baptizes over 8,000 people in the state of Kentucky. I know of no Baptist preachers baptized more people than Jeremiah Vardaman. Vardaman was a member for a while, probably there, or certainly as a young child, went to that separate Baptist church. And when they started Crab Orchard Baptist Church, it's called Crab Orchard now, when they started, he was probably baptized there and became a member there. But they kicked him out because he started playing violin down at the Whitley House. They had dancing down there. And you can't dance, you know that. And in fact, most of you, like myself, wouldn't have a snowball's chance in every church back then. We'd all be thrown out. But watching TV especially. But he goes down, he gets thrown out of church. He moves down to Pulaski County, that's Somerset. And he finds a young lady down there whose family helped start that area, the James family. And he marries Elizabeth James. And he gets his heart right with God, and he ends up going back up to Crab Orchard, and they make him the pastor. He pastored there from 1802 to 1810, goes up farther north, pastors number church, finally ends up moving to Missouri, start churches out there, and end up dying out there, and we put a monument up for him out there. But I mention him because of his wife, Elizabeth James. He was married three times. Boy, these old preachers, let me tell you something about these old preachers. They went through wives like I don't know what, because the wives, man, listen, ladies, I'm going to take up for you here, okay? These men, me included, don't understand sometimes what you ladies go through. And I certainly don't understand years ago when these ladies, you take Elizabeth James, she comes in this marriage, she falls in love with Jeremiah Vardaman, she doesn't know she's going to have 15 or 16 kids. And then she dies young. Well, Lord, no wonder. And then he marries again. His wife has a couple of kids. Then he marries again. She has some kids. He's got about 20 kids floating around. And he finally the third wife outlives him. But these women had it hard back then. I'll tell you one thing. This transgender bunch wouldn't want to be a woman back then. I'll guarantee you that. They wouldn't want to be a woman back then. But Vardaman baptized more people. And his wife, James, her cousin is Robert Sally James. Robert Sally James goes to Georgetown College up in Georgetown, Kentucky. He becomes a Baptist preacher. He moves to Missouri. He gets married. Well, he actually marries in Lexington. Takes his wife with him to Missouri. Robert Sally James doesn't last very long because he ends up in California and dies of cholera just a few weeks after he gets there. But his wife has two children by him before he leaves. One of them's named Frank, one of them's Jesse James. Their daddy was a Baptist preacher. Went to college right here in Kentucky. In fact, when Frank got out of prison, somebody said he became a great teacher in a Baptist church. I don't know, maybe he did. I've just heard that. But then you got other preachers that came here. Andrew Tribble. Tribble lived in Virginia. He was good friends with Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson was an Anglican, Church of England man. But he said, I used to go to Tribble's church and watch how they conducted business meetings. And he said, I got the idea for democracy for this country by watching how Tribble and them did their business meetings in their church. Tribble would eventually move here to Kentucky, come to Richmond, start Tate's Creek Baptist Church. He's buried up there behind the church. Our state is just full of so much history. John Gannot. John Gannot was pastor of First Baptist Church in New York City when the Revolutionary War broke out. That the British took the city of New York. He had to leave. He became a chaplain under Washington. I present credible evidence in the book that he baptized George Washington. He would end up as a 60-year-old man here in the state of Kentucky, and he finds himself up here in the Lexington area, the Frankfort area, in fact, right there in that area where that big museum is in Frankfort. He used to own all that land in there, and he's buried in Frankfort Cemetery. But we have so much history in our church or in our state because people wanted their religious freedom. And the reason you and I sit here this morning, and I could go on and on and on and on with these stories, but get the book. It's $8. If you ain't got $8, just take the book. I don't care. It ain't a money-making project. You can't. This is a hardback book. If you ain't got $8, just take it. Go on. That's fine. Not a problem to me. We give away as many as we sell. But I want you to understand this. There's been a price that has been paid for our freedom to worship God. There's been a price paid for you to be able to sit here today to be able to worship God. You've never worried about it. Now, in the future, I'm afraid things are going to change. I'm afraid things are going to change. But you think about this. You've never had to worry about somebody coming in and grabbing your child and scalping them. You never had to worry about somebody taking your baby out of a crib, slamming their head up against a tree. You never had to worry about somebody doing something like that. You never had to do that. But somebody did, and they did it for religious freedom so you and I could sit here today and worship God the way we want to. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I really don't. I don't think it's going to be pretty. I don't think it's going to be pretty. I turned 69 years old July the 9th. And I'm going to tell you something. I've seen a lot happen in my lifetime. But you know what? I wouldn't trade being 69 for 39 for nothing, because we're heading down a dark road. And you say, well, God, he'll take care of it. Let me tell you something. There comes a time when God does take care of it, but he doesn't necessarily take care of it the way we want him to. There comes a time, biblically speaking, when, and I'm talking about eschatology now, when God's had all he wants of it, and God's going to say, enough's enough. You realize that from the time of creation to the flood, it was 1,750 years before God got mad enough to say, that's enough. Do you realize from the time of the flood until the Tower of Babel, you've got another, 800 and some years? No, more longer than that. Probably 800 years or so. Until God said, that's enough. I'm going to go down. I'm going to confound their language. You realize when Jesus walked in the Cana in the New Testament and said, woe unto you, you realize they lasted 1,200 years before God said, enough's enough. We've been around 240 years and we've messed this up in 240 years. What do you think God's going to think about that? Listen, folks, appreciate where you come from. Appreciate where you're going. Appreciate the people who paid a price that you and I could be here today. But most of all, appreciate the fact that Jesus died for you on Calvary's cross so you go to heaven one of these days. Man, I'm looking forward to that, ain't you? I trust you're going. I'm just going to say this, and I'm going to turn it over to the preacher. Before you leave this building, I hope Jesus is very real in your heart. Here's my always been my plan for presenting the gospel. Got it from Bobby Richardson, used to play for the New York Yankees. On a scale of 1 to 10, what are your chances are going to heaven? You'll be surprised how many Baptists say 8 or 9. I'm going to tell you something. If it ain't 10, you need to do business with God, all right? God bless you, preacher, church.